Unabashed.
The most unpredictable
becomes a headline.
The most volatile,
outrageous behavior,
unsubstantiated narratives,
a battle of personalities.
Welcome to Grand Tamasha, a co-production of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the Hindustan Times. I'm your host, Milan Vaishnav. Few regions of the world have gotten more attention in the first few months of the Biden administration than Asia. And within Asia, top leaders from Secretary of State Blinken to Secretary of Defense Austin to President Biden himself have singled out the importance of the Indo-Pacific region in particular. To discuss why this region has gotten such significant airtime and to help us understand what shape great power competition might take there, I am pleased to welcome Darshna Barua to the podcast. Darshna is an associate fellow with the South Asia program at Carnegie, and she leads our brand new Indian Ocean Initiative. Darshna, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Milan.
So it is nice to be colleagues again. We were colleagues once before when you were with Carnegie India in Delhi, and we look forward to having you shortly in Washington. We're very excited about this new Indian Ocean Initiative, but I wanted to ask you about the choice of name, because if you look around Washington, you know, all things Indo-Pacific are like all the rage these days. Everywhere you go, there's Indo-Pacific something. But the initiative that you're leading is not called that. It's called the Indian Ocean Initiative. What's the thinking here?
Thanks, Milan. First, let me start by saying that it's a highlight in itself to, as an Indian working in this space, to make it to Grand Tamasha. So thank you so much.
You need to expand your ambitions.
So thank you so much for that. But thank you. Yeah, absolutely. There's so much work on the Indo-Pacific. So I guess to briefly answer the question why an Indian Ocean Initiative amidst the Indo-Pacific craze is to fill a gap. There's a lot of work on the Indo-Pacific and there's a lot of work on the Pacific, but there is very little attention on the Indian Ocean as such. And even so, on the Indian Ocean region as one theater or as a whole. So the idea is to have this initiative study the different actors, different dynamics of the Indian Ocean region and how those dynamics and how those actors and players affect the larger Indo-Pacific framework. It's kind of one is to see what is happening in the Indian Ocean region, how they interact with each other and how the actors interact between the smaller players and the bigger players, but also what consequences or what implications it would carry for the larger security debate and the Indo-Pacific framework. So it's essentially to become that one-stop shop for all thing Indian Oceans and fill in the gap into what does the Indian Ocean or what role does the Indian Ocean play within the Indo-Pacific framework.
You know, one question that I think comes to some people's minds when we're talking about this region is, you know, why launch an initiative on the Indian Ocean right now, right? As you think about the kind of global landscape, there's certainly no shortage of threats and opportunities on the horizon. We have issues with Iran, Afghanistan, of course, North Korea. What is it about this region beyond the kind of sheer size and expanse that makes it worthy of such special attention, particularly at this juncture in time?
No, absolutely. You're right. I mean, there's no shortage of global threats and kind of challenges, especially within the Indo-Pacific framework itself, which is quite vast. But I think many of the issues that you outlined yourself right now converge in the Indian Ocean region, whether it's non-traditional security threats like illegal fishing or energy security or climate change or even greater traditional security issues, which is naval competition or kind of geopolitical great power competition. The Indian Ocean region is vast, but it is also home to three critical sub-regions, which is South Asia, Middle East, and the eastern coast of Africa, all of which carry carry implications and value or impact the larger global security or even the Indo-Pacific framework. So they all converge in the Indian Ocean region, bring in the smaller island nations dotting the southern part of the Indian Ocean. It is an area that requires attention to understand how it has evolved, how it has changed in the post-Cold War era, and especially in the new security dynamic where you're seeing much more competition between whether it's India, China, whether it's US, China, and the different dynamics within amongst themselves. So that is one reason why we're looking at Indian Ocean region in terms of as one space and not kind of a sub-region of or a sub-territory of the Indo-Pacific region and how that impacts the larger framework.
You know, you mentioned kind of great powers, and of all of the key powers who have a role to play in the Indian Ocean, you've noted in other work that China is really the only one with a diplomatic mission and a serious presence in all six key island nations. So these are Sri Lanka, Maldives, Mauritius, Seychelles, Madagascar, Comoros. Some of these countries you hear about, and some of them aren't on most of our radar screens. You know, one gets the sense that China is filling very methodically a kind of huge vacuum that's been created since the end of the Cold War. And I'm wondering, is this stepped up Chinese presence the sort of result of the United States that's been distracted and that hasn't been able to kind of engage on a sustained basis over successive presidential administrations? Or is there something more complicated at work?
I think it's a little bit of both. In terms of creating the foundation, I think China has created that engagement or the diplomatic presence, regardless of what anybody else was doing. And I think that's attached to more their larger goals or ambitions. Or, you know, China has been clearly articulating that they want to be a maritime power. They want to be a great power. In fact, China's diplomatic mission in Comoros was in 1975. So that was the heart of the Cold War period, right? At that, so they have been engaging with the region for a long time, quietly establishing the diplomatic presence, the political presence. The step up is new in terms of really the intensified collaborations and more focused on whether it's military, whether it is economic, whether it's really a vaccine diplomacy or aid assistance or disaster relief. And China has been able to take on a lot of these missions in the last decade or so. The anti-piracy mission was the most concrete deployment into the Indian Ocean region, but they've also used that to interact more with the region around it. And as and after the Cold War, as kind of, you know, especially in the 90s and the early part of this century, the United States was more involved in the issues of the Middle East and the Pacific. And you had India, which wasn't really looking to the Indian Ocean as much because there was not much of a competition. There's France, which is really limited to the Western Indian Ocean, but has really deep and complicated colonial history with many of the island nations. So yes, and then came the question of, you know, filling a vacuum. One was filling the vacuum and the other was to offer an alternative to two dominant security providers in the Indian Ocean, France in the Western Indian Ocean and India in the Eastern Indian Ocean, and their dominant behavior towards the island nation. So it was kind of, I think it was factors merged with each other, which was China's own creating the foundation to the region with diplomatic and political engagements, and now seeking or utilizing this moment where they see a vacuum to actually do something concrete and build on it.
You know, this week in the Hindustan Times, you had a piece called "It Is Time to Reimagine the Indian Ocean." And in it, you know, you note that one of the great difficulties that Washington faces, and I think India probably does to a certain extent as well, is, you know, we have a tendency to engage with the Indian Ocean in silos, right? Coming back to something you said earlier, as opposed to sort of looking at it holistically. And, you know, on the other hand, we have a Biden administration that's come in. It's embodied much of the rhetoric about thinking more holistically. We now have an Indo-Pacific coordinator in the White House. We are told at least that regional bureaus, whether it's Africa, mm-hmm. East Asia, South Asia, are working more closely together at the State Department because they understand the negative ramifications of these silos. So do you think that the U.S. has kind of resolved some of its bureaucratic hurdles or impediments, or do you think there's a lot more to be done on that front?
I think this is just the first step toward really addressing the many silos that that exist. The bureaucracy, whether it's Washington or Delhi or even Tokyo or Canberra, it has worked in these silos for so long that it's going to take time to actually, you know, work smooth over the seams that have been there, the imaginary lines and kind of the division, right? So yes, the Indo-Pacific coordinator will look at it, but within that, I think there has to be also understanding at the working level, the bureaucratic level, of the importance of the regions and the importance of or what's happening on the region. And that, I think, has been missing for some decades now, because unlike in the, I think, 70s and 80s, today, smaller nations carry a lot more agency, especially at the UN. And if the United States, if UK, if India, if Japan are going to be talking about this rules-based order, rules-based international order, then you have to really cater to what the smaller nations are saying and what they are doing. If I can just give one example, which is the issue of Diego Garcia, which is kind of the Mauritius claim, you know, the debate between Mauritius and London, where US has a base in Diego Garcia. And the United Nations, I mean, at the UN General Assembly, adopted a resolution which said that UK is illegally occupying the territory. United Nations have officially changed the maps to show Diego Garcia as part of Mauritius. But then you still have where London is not really engaging in a conversation and saying that, well, it doesn't apply to me. It's not to take away the importance of the base, but then the fact that we have divisions of bureaucracy hasn't been able to understand how this is actually impacting the conversation among smaller nations in the region, where they're saying that, okay, fine, China doesn't abide by rules, but so doesn't UK or US. So how does it matter? Why should I say that the Western disregard for rules-based order is acceptable, but for the Eastern countries, it's not? It's changing the whole conversation on the ground, but because of the distance from these smaller nations and being actually present on the region, I don't think so headquarters is getting an idea of what actually is happening on the ground and how it's changing the conversation. So absolutely, creating a division that looks at it holistically is a first step forward, but it would require much more, I think, reorientation amongst the bureaucracy and officials to again start understanding the region through new dynamics, where countries in the 60s and 70s did not carry that much of heft, today actually carries a lot of agency.
Yeah, and what you're saying really is it's kind of a change in kind of worldview and mindset, right? I mean, because of the pressures and constraints that government officials operate under, they're often focused on things once a crisis emerges, right? When something blows up. But then you notice that, you know, China has come in, filled a vacuum, you're very reactive, and you're kind of misreading perhaps some of the local political and geopolitical dynamics, you know, in the region. We've seen a lot of high-level activity already in the first couple of months of the Biden administration when it comes to this part of the world. I think it was just a week or two ago that U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin took a very early trip to India to meet with his counterpart Rajnath Singh. We didn't see a lot of big flashy headlines, and frankly, you wouldn't expect a lot of big flashy headlines this early administration. But in your Hindustan Times piece, you did note that we got a kind of glimpse or a sneak preview of several areas of potential collaboration that the two countries might look forward to. Tell us a bit more about what you sort of see, you know, kind of emerging over the horizon.
Sure. One of the key things for, at least for the Indo-Pacific or Indian Ocean in bilateral relationship between India and US, was to figure out really concrete or, you know, issue-based, issue-focused areas that the two can work together. Okay, now you agree that Indo-Pacific is a new theater and you have the basic values and democracy and all of that set out. You agree on all of that. So now what next, kind of a question. So the problem in the Indian Ocean between India and US was the division of combatant commands, the way Washington looks at the Indian Ocean region and the way India looks at it. The way Washington was looking at it was that it ended with India, whereas India's went all the way to Africa. So the question that India and US will now work across the Indo-Pacific Command, Africa Command, and Central Command was a big step forward, which was to recognize that there's a difference in how we define the geography and there needs to be work towards it. Austin also specifically mentioned the Western Indian Ocean, which is where there is a gap and there's a recognition that more needs to be done. In terms of issues, they again reemphasize the foundational agreements, Limoa, Becca, Comcasa, which was really important. But specifically,
and these are just for those who aren't initiated, foundational agreements that help the U.S. and Indian militaries do more together, right? These are sort of enabling agreements that allow them to cooperate, to do exercises, interoperability, budgeting, essentially, you know, kind of have the different pieces of the puzzle fit together.
Yeah, it helps kind of smooth over the paperwork. It's easier access. You have nodal point of contact, whether it's communications, whether it's kind of access to each other's facilities. So these are like foundational agreements that help you do more going forward. And in terms of specific issues as well, they mentioned information sharing, which really, so for the Indian Navy right now, the priority is kind of anti-submarine warfare under maritime domain awareness. And this is somewhere where US and India are really interested in information and intelligence sharing. I think we saw some of it even during the Ladakh crisis, where there was some sort of, you know, utilization of the foundational agreement to share information on what is happening between on the border. They talked about Limoa. They talked about, so for the longest time, there was a huge resistance towards, say, anybody coming into Andaman and Nicobar Islands, which are kind of closer to the Straits of Malacca, and India would just kind of keep it closed. But last November, you had USP-8s landing there for the first time, and that's something that Washington had been pushing for a long time, because it's really strategically placed to carry anti-submarine warfare, you know, to exercise interoperability and do a lot of MDA-related missions. So I think it was, the terminologies were broad, but then it was couched on, it gave the umbrella for the very specific initiatives that India and US are going to look at, which I think is ASW, intelligence sharing, information sharing. The other part of it was a lot of non-traditional security issues. They mentioned like responding to oil spill. Last year, there was a huge issue off the coast of Mauritius where there was kind of a tanker, oil tanker that ran aground, and it took a lot of time to actually kind of offer assistance to remove that, clear it. It harms the ecosystem. It pollutes the ocean. So there are real issues, disaster, illegal fishing. So these are all areas that India and US are looking to work together, and it overlaps between non-traditional security issues and security issues. So I think this was more a trip which was one to emphasize that what has been agreed on so far stays in place, which is foundational agreements, the broader picture. And now using these foundational agreements, where do we go? So that is defense sector or AI or ASW or MDA, illegal fishing, oil spills. So I think these are the specific issues that have been outlined in going forward.
You know, one of the issues on the kind of non-traditional side that came up during the Quad meeting, of course, was climate change. And I want to ask you about that. But before we get there, let me ask you about India's strategy. One of the points that you've made in this HT piece, but you've also made another work, is that, you know, when you look at the kind of budgetary allocations, the Indian Navy perhaps does not get the sort of attention that it would like. It's allotted less than 15% of the country's defense budget. Many analysts kind of look at that and say, well, wait a second, this shows a kind of lack of commitment to the maritime domain. Is this a fair criticism? You know, can you read off the budget and say, okay, that means that this is kind of underemphasized? And beyond the issue of money alone, what are other steps that you would like to see the Indian government take to really kind of step up its game on this front?
This definitely is a tough question. It's a yes and a no, because compared to the maritime domain, India's threats and hostility on the northern border is much more and much more imminent. So the justification that, you know, issues on the continental border gets more budget is, I wouldn't say is unfair or kind of, you know, unjustified. To a certain extent, it definitely is.
And of course, as we're recording this, you know, India and China still remain in this standoff along the line of actual control that, you know, we've seen some positive signs of disengagement. But of course, the situation still remains very tense.
Absolutely. So those threats and hustles are very real and very imminent, right? It's something that India faces much more often and much more in real time. The question of resource constraint is real. I mean, at the end of the day, India still, you know, has so many of its population under poverty. It's very hard to justify a bigger defense budget on it, and its ambitions are bigger than what it can be matched. But I think the issue is also the lack of understanding of the maritime domain and maritime geography and how it can help or how it impacts India's larger strategic interests. For a country that wishes to do so much with a very limited budget, a lot of the issues can be addressed through partnerships, where it is happening now, like say Limo and other areas that we have seen. But a lot of the developments that we've seen in the last 5 to 6 years is also reactionary. You have India launching initiatives like Asia-Africa Growth Corridor with Japan, which came up in like 16, 17. We've seen vision statements. Not a single project has come out of it, because it was kind of a reaction to Belt and Road Initiative without really understanding what's happening on the region, which goes back to the question of, does the bureaucracy really understand the region and have they interacted with it? So I think it's also a change in our mindsets. And that's why I use the word our mental maps of the Indian Ocean and the HDPs, because I think that's a real problem in the sense of, just to give an example, right? Indian diplomats posted to smaller island nations is considered unimportant or kind of a punishment. It's like, oh, you're so far away, it's not an important posting. But that comes because you don't look at the maritime domain as something that is strategically important. Beyond the budgetary, the capital and the money part of it, I think one thing that I would like to see is more introduction, more education, more conversation around the importance of maritime geography in foreign service training and kind of our officials, whether it's defense and both military and foreign service officials. There has been so many conversations. Even when I was in 2016, I was in Australia for a few months working on India-Australia collaboration. And I just repeatedly got this question. It's like, you know, why? Why do you care? Well, it's so far away, nothing's going to happen. And recently we had the biggest India-Australia maritime exercise. It's become one of our biggest partners. So I think it's the lack of understanding that that also stops or is a challenge in realizing how to utilize India's partnerships and the maritime domain with the limited budget. In some areas, absolutely more resources are required. But in others, I think it's really a restructuring in a way to get the most out of its partnerships. But to be able to do that, you have to first understand the geography. The average Indian, even whether it is whoever an aspiring civil servant or foreign service official, understands the border issue with Pakistan and China.
Right.
Right. The Indian Ocean, most people, like you said, they wouldn't even know what lies where in the geography.
Right.
The map, you don't know where it starts, where it ends. There's very little conversations on it. And I think that impacts our bureaucracy itself.
I mean, I have to admit, Darshana, when I get emails from you saying that you're in some far-flung island, I have to look it up on the map because I myself am not confident I know where that is. The Quad has come up a couple of times in this conversation. And of course, a few weeks ago, the heads of state of the Quad nations, that is, of course, India, the United States, Australia, Japan, they met virtually to discuss how this grouping might work together in the future. I want to ask you a question that I actually posed to the Indian ambassador to the United States, who was on the program last week, which is that, you know, there has been a general sense among many of our colleagues who look at this region that India has been somewhat skeptical, cautious, reluctant when it comes to embracing this concept of the Quad. Do you think that this reluctance is a thing of the past? And if so, what do you think has changed?
I definitely think India is doing more within the Quad framework, as or at least signaling that it wants to do more, especially with the summit level conversation that has happened. But I think it will depend on the issues. You know, India still quite concerned or would be cautious about what kind of issues they work with. So far, the Quad has actually emphasized non-traditional security issues, whether it was the Indian Ocean tsunami years ago or the vaccine diplomacy today. And even the Quad summit, the statement that came out of the four countries, it really emphasizes on kind of non-traditional security issues, whether it's climate change, whether it's kind of renewable energy, illegal fishing, or of course, more traditional, so with cyber.
And they announced the creation of a new working group on kind of emerging technologies and cyber and so on.
Yeah. And using that technology and using all of that to also address the issues of the region. So the one thing I think that was repeatedly used a phrase was that Quad is a force for good, right? Like, you know, so you have to kind of create that image or create that narrative that Quad is not there for containment of military expansion of any country, but, you know, it's that force for good that is going to answer your problems, regional problems, by bringing together the resources of the four countries. So, and why that change has come, I think it has been a couple of reasons. One is India's own. India was amongst the Quad, India was the last country to officially adopt the Indo-Pacific. It was only in 2018 at the Shangri-La Dialogue where they formally said, okay, yes, this is what happens. And the second is, of course, the China question. The question, even 2018-19, after you adopted the Indo-Pacific, there was this thing of, you know, okay, how much should you compete with China? You know, do you really, you have to be careful so that, you know, you don't overdo it and you don't invite trouble. But I think the entire conversation changed last summer. After the Ladakh issue, the China conversation changed to the extent that it's basically now given that it is a threat, it is a competition. Whether India chooses to engage with the West or not, China is very clear on the border issue and what it wants to do. So it's up to, I guess, India how it does it, how it engages or how it responds to it. And I have always looked at India's acceptance of the Indo-Pacific or the Quad as an area of opportunity because it allows India to address a bigger security concern with limited resources by pulling those resources from its partners who might have the expertise or the capital or the assets, you know, the idea of addressing a particular issue through a true kind of, you know, true collaborations. And I think finally, it's also, it helps, the idea helps India's own mission, Modi's own kind of thing that India is a global power, it's a big power. You have the biggest countries, you know, the cool boys supporting India, you know, its place in the world, right? So you have the biggest support from these regional support from the Western countries, some of these Southeast Asian countries as well. So it plays to a lot of the things India wants to do itself, that it has envisioned for itself with the limited resources that it has, and the China factor, which is a real security threat. So I think these are the factors that have shaped the road that India has taken. But of course, there will be some cautious even at this level because, you know, it's a generational shift in terms of like working with the West or working with a coalition or collaboration. You know, we still have people who remember the Cold War, who remember 71, who remember, you know, the way India and U.S. has been. So there will be that level of cautiousness. But I think the relationship has really, you know, worked. I mean, come a long, long way. And it has required some real work from both sides. So I'm hopeful. Let's see.
You know, Sadanand Dume, who is a regular on the show, when we spoke a couple of weeks ago on the program, you know, I asked him if the idea of non-alignment was dead. And he said it's like that zombie from a horror film that every time you kind of drive a stake into its heart, it won't die, right? It stays around.
Yeah.
What you said about China, I found really interesting because, you know, I think there's have been a serious series of events, whether it was Doklam, whether it was the border incursions that happened during Xi Jinping's first visit when Modi became prime minister, and of course the most recent incident. So I think an, you know, emerging, changing conception of the Chinese threat. But what you're saying is that within the idea of sort of China-India competition, the entrance of the relevance of this in the maritime domain, as opposed to just the land border, has also become more kind of ingrained in people's minds. Is that fair to say?
Of course, the land issue is much more dominant amongst the average Indian or in the public discourse, right? But at the government level, at the services level, the maritime domain definitely has played a part in it because so far, India was under the thing that, okay, at least we have an advantageous position in the Indian Ocean region. But the idea that China can gap that
right
kind of challenge
can
in the
can kind of erode in, that position.
Yeah. So you have now a stronger China both on the northern and southern border. That is a real concern.
Right.
And I think it is also the realization that China is real about its what it wants, where it sees itself in the global order, right? And in that, it will go, if it has to compete with India, it will compete with India. I mean, India is still a very smaller factor compared to China's competition with the United States, right? So whether India chooses to engage with other countries or not is not going to affect how China engages with India. China is going to engage with India in comparison to its larger global ambitions. And this is something that I think is also true for Washington. Whether Washington wants to engage in the Indian Ocean or not, it's not going to affect China's engagement in the region. China is doing that regardless. So I think it's both for whether it's in Delhi or Washington, it's to figure out where the strategic interests lie and what the vision is itself. Otherwise, we're just going to get wrapped up in reactionary policies that we saw in the initial period.
I mean, I guess that's where the impetus behind sort of framing this as a force for good also comes from, right? Because then it's sort of, you know, there are reasons to be doing this, not just to counter China, Belt and Road, and so on, but actually because it's in our collective national interests. You know, just sticking with Washington for a second, we've heard a lot for the past 4 or 5 years about America's Indo-Pacific strategy. It seems like a think tank is hosting an event on this, right, almost every week. And one of the things that you hear is that, particularly from U.S. government officials, is that, you know, finally, as a country, we have a more coherent vision for the region that can guide our engagement. And, you know, critics have suggested that, you know, while there might be a clear diplomatic strategy, a clear military strategy, that there's not necessarily a coherent economic strategy, particularly after the United States withdrew from the Trans-Pacific Partnership and so on. So as somebody who has spent a lot of time in the region, including in many of these smaller island nations, how would you sort of assess from a kind of macro level America's Indo-Pacific strategy? And do you think that the economic dimension is very clearly lagging behind? Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think the Indo-Pacific strategy, and this is not just for Washington for most, is a work in progress. And right now, within that framework, the strategic part plays a bigger role than the economic part of it. I think the aim is to create where does it fit in the larger geopolitical context or the strategic context, because there's so much development happening. And I think the developments led by China is at a much faster pace than any of the governments have been able to respond. Right. So it's cropping up in different places. You have China, you know, on a standoff with India at the border. You have China deploying for longer periods of time around the Senkakus for Japan. You have China on a diplomatic standoff with Australia. You have Chinese fishing vessels in Philippines. So it's happening at a major areas where it's affecting not just Washington, but Washington's partners and allies as well. So I think the priorities perhaps to place where the Indo-Pacific exists within the larger geopolitical context, within the larger strategic context. The economic, of course, I think it'll need much more work because the economic piece is much harder. Even when it was Asia-Pacific, right, India was really on the outside of it. It wasn't really considered as part of it. There was a separate kind of, from the geopolitical part of it, point of view. But I do see, I have had conversations where this is something that governments are looking at and how to integrate more, how to bring in the economic piece into it. I'm not entirely sure how this will work out because I think the Indo-Pacific is too broad for the economic piece of it and that maybe it might require more work in smaller groupings or kind of perhaps and then again, there are countries like India, you know, there are many other countries who take a different approach than maybe most of the players. So I think you're right in saying the economic part of it is not one piece. But at the same time, I think there has been attempts to address the economic question, whether it is through infrastructure development, whether it's through aid, whether it's through development assistance in terms of what the countries need. But that has also been to a certain extent reactionary. So once you have the Indo-Pacific more solidified in terms of what it means for each nation's larger geopolitical interest or strategic interest, maybe it might become slightly easier to figure out the economics piece.
You know, I want to end by asking you about this issue of climate change, which we kind of circled around earlier. It's one of the three areas, as you pointed out, that the Quad explicitly mentioned in their joint statement as a kind of priority for them to work on. There's a new working group on the issue that'll look at how they can work together to kind of mitigate some of the impacts of climate change. What impact will climate change have on this region? And what is the link between climate change and sort of great power competition in the Indian Ocean more broadly?
Right. To answer the first question, in terms of how does climate change affect the region, is that the climate change is a much more of an existential threat to smaller island nations, whether it's Sri Lanka all the way to Comoros. When I was in Comoros, there was 6 months before there was a cyclone, a small cyclone, and they had still not fully recovered from the effects of it, because these are smaller countries and they feel the effect or change of climate change, whether it's from cyclones, whether it's from typhoon. Tsunamis are a big concern in the Indian Ocean region. And these are all, and you need a lot of capacity, you need a lot of capital to recover from these. Population is not that big. So even loss of human capital, kind of, you know, true disasters is a big deal. The navies or the coast guards are not as big as your smaller, as your bigger nations, whether it's India or Japan. So the ability to offer that assistance is not that high. So climate change is definitely a key issue for most of these countries. And in fact, when you look at the debates at the UN and you look at what are the smaller countries talking about, climate change is right at the top of the agenda. They define climate change in the top five national security issue. And the bigger powers, climate change is probably not the top five security issue, but it's an important issue. So you've seen it come up more in joint statements out of the realization that if countries are jostling over having influence or having better ties with smaller nations, then you're going to have to work with them on issues that matter to them. And climate change is number one. So take, for example, India and Japan want to do something in the Indian Ocean region, and you don't want to do something from a military point of view because Japan has constitutional limitations and you want to work within it's a force for good kind of a construct. So you work together in building tsunami warning centers, or you work together in offering capacity to respond to disaster, or you work in a way where you institutionalize your presence in the region. So you are the first there to offer assistance, whether it's cyclone, whether it's tsunami, whether it's typhoon, whether it's a crisis, food shortage or water crisis. We've seen something like this in Maldives in 2016. So this is how it will impact great power competition, in the sense that who is able to be there to offer the assistance, who gets there first, and to be able to do that because the region is so vast, you have to interact more with these countries. You have to be present around those waters. For that, you have to have that capacity to sustain yourself for longer periods of deployments. I think that is the biggest kind of change in the security environment today that I see, which is the overlap of non-traditional security issues and its impact on traditional security issues. I think earlier we were able to draw a very clear line to say, okay, these are softer issues, these are harder issues, and let's keep the two different. You don't need the Navy for softer issue or areas. And now it's the opposite, which is you have fishing vessels doing a kind of information gathering or surveillance missions, you know. So you have these overlap of non-traditional security issues and security issues. And I think that's where climate change is going to matter a lot more, because of the geographies of the islands, because of the maritime domain and how it impacts these smaller nations who all hold a vote each at the United Nations, which is very important for the rules-based international order framework.
My guest on the show today has been Darshna Barua. She is an associate fellow with the South Asia program at the Carnegie Endowment, where she leads our brand new Indian Ocean Initiative. Darshna, courtesy of the wonders of the internet, has joined us virtually from Tokyo. Darshna, thank you for coming onto the show and sharing some of your insights with us, and look forward to seeing you in Washington very soon.
Thank you, Mulan. Thank you. This was great. Thank you so much for having me.
So one note to our listeners, this is a bit of a bittersweet note. Our beloved executive producer, Maya Krishna Rogers, is leaving us for greener pastures. This is her last episode, but she has been with us for seasons 4 and season 5 of the show. And on behalf of myself and Tim and our entire crew, we just want to thank her. We wish her well. She has big shoes to fill, but thank you, Maya, for everything you've done. And we should point out for our listeners that Maya's nani is not only our most loyal, but perhaps our first listener, not our only listener, but our first listener. And so Maya's nani, wherever you are, you should be very proud of Maya. We're going to miss her, but please still listen to the show.
Grantham Asha is a co-production of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the Hindustan Times. This podcast is an HD Smartcast original and is available on hdsmartcast.com, India's fastest growing podcasting producing platform. You can also find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to rate and review. It helps others find the show more easily. For more information about the show and to find the writing we referenced on this week's episode, visit our website, granttamasha.com. Production assistance comes from Jonathan Kay, Tim Martin is our audio engineer, and Maya Krishna Rogers is our executive producer. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.
This was a Hindustan Times production, brought to you by HD Smartcast.
HD Smartcast.
Did I just say nanny?